that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. X-Go, give it to you. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. That's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? X-Go, give it to you. Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Give up. Order now at Acura.com.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Hey folks, it's Unsung once more. Hi. Mark, my good friend Chris.
My good friend Chris.
This week we're talking about buildings and life without them.
And Sprekisang.
And Sprekisang.
I don't know why I do a baritone voice automatically. You can actually do it like that.
You can actually do it. Yes, in opera they do a lot of this, don't they?
They do, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of wasted.
Yeah. Starting your band.
No, I mean, I just think I'm wasted. I had a lot of vodka before you got here.
And painkillers.
Anyway, side B of Life Without Buildings, Any Other City.
Yes. So last week we kind of dived a little bit into the world of what Chris was talking about there, which is Sprekisang.
Sprekisang. And Sprekstimme.
Which we're not going to really do too much explanation as to what that is now.
Go back and listen to the first
we've
sign.
Done that in the last episode.
All we can say is that the Rammstein song Mutter, uses it quite a bit.
And Sonne as well.
Die Sonne scheint mir aus den Augen. Wird heute Nacht nicht untergehen und die Welt zählt laut bis 10.
Yeah, that's true. It's just Rammstein in general and their operatic ways. But we cited a lot of kind of historic examples of it, but I think a good way to pick up in this episode is to look at some of the resurgent movement in post-punk where this has become very au fait. So I think it's pretty well established that in the last 4 years or so, as post-punks come back through, there is a predominance of a singing approach that is not, like you mentioned, could Interpol really take off now? I don't think to the same extent, because those bands that are coming back with a post-punk vibe are not trying to sing anywhere like as much. Mm-hmm. There's a really loose, languid, slightly more punky, streetsy take on it.
Yep.
And yeah, there's plenty of notable recent examples, but I found a couple of articles that were kind of addressing this phenomenon, and I'll refer to them now and then because they're pretty good. In 2021, The Ringer wrote about the phenomenon saying, quote, "The style seems to have particularly crystallised around a loosely defined scene of buzzy, politically charged UK post-punk bands who tend to talk more than they sing, reciting lyrics in an alternately disaffected or tightly wound voice. And yet it does seem to have a particularly strong association with an English accent or English accents. Obviously Slayford Mods, Life Without Buildings that we're talking about, Dry Cleaning.
Weak arms can't open the door, can't feed council. It'll be okay, I just need to be weird and hide for a bit and eat an old sandwich from my bag.
These kind of bands, very prominent English accents, even if the accents themselves are different. Florence Shaw, who's the vocalist in the band Dry Cleaning, does say in that Ringer article, quote, "Because of the vocals, we were expecting people to be a bit nonplussed by us. In large part, the success is thanks to the fact that there is this group of bands who were all investigating the same thing." Mm-hmm. And she's right. Like, there was suddenly this movement where this style of vocal became really, really common. And just a whole generation of music fan, their ears were really conditioned to it. And it's led to a number of these acts doing really, really well. Cream.com, like Cream, C-R-E-E-M, they published a head-to-head debate on the subject between two of their writers. The article is actually titled "The British Post-Punk Band is Dead, Long Live the British Post-Punk Band," if you want to go and read it. The intro to that reads, "We're questioning everyone's boner for all those Sprechgesang new wave post-punk fish and chip poppers coming out of the UK and Ireland right now." And they do say during that discussion, in particular on Dry Cleaning, quote, "I get bored. Why am I not listening to Life Without Buildings right now?" And for one, I personally agree with that sentiment. But some of the acts that come up in this discussion of the resurgence, let's just throw a few out there. I mean, Slayford Mods. Dead from the waste of space up, chili chicken ramen and off pale dead deer on the road. Look, I tipped up, that's how he's in it on the high street. When they're eating the rats, you want to put a bit of salt in it, you jealous twat. How many fucking more times can I mention this band in this show?
Yeah.
I am on record as not being a fan of Slayford Mods. I get what they're doing. We'll not retread all of that. It's almost rappy.
Oh, it's very close to that.
It reminds me a bit of The Streets.
That's what I was going to say. The Streets is the reference point there, and I think that's probably where a lot of it comes from, right?
That blue top shop top you've got on is nice. Bit too much fake tan, no, but yeah, you score high. But there's just one little thing that's really, 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 really annoying me about you, you see. Yeah, yeah, like I said, you are really fit, but my gosh.
Don't necessarily know if they're influenced that much by American hip-hop, but there's a little bit of that, I guess, in some of the cadences, but it definitely reminds me more of The Streets and that kind of... Guess was he doing like garage or grime? I don't even think he was.
It was kind of light. It was like a light version of that that was quite accessible to sort of like white middle class kids and like the British mainstream, you know. Not that it was terrible. I mean, I did not like it, but he did well for a while. You know, he was taken really seriously. And
did we not do a Streets album? Sounds a pound.
I don't know if we did. I remember discussing them, but I don't know if I think it was more in reference to someone else. But I mean, Slayford Mods have really, they've built their house in that, right? They've got these like blippy backing tracks, whatever you think of their performance, it's shite, you can think what you want, but the vocal approach is just this,
it's the guy for Park Life.
It's exactly the guy for Park Life. One that I mentioned in the last episode, Enablers. Now, this is a San Franciscan band.
Enabler.
What is that called?
Funny, it's just a funny word.
It's a good word.
That's from, is it Hot Fuzz or Shaun of the Dead? I think it's Hot Fuzz.
Is that why you said that in that accent?
Enabler.
That West Country accent.
Enabler.
So the Enablers, or is it just Enablers? I can't remember. They're on Neurot, which is Neurosis' label. They had an album in 2004, particularly worthy of investigation, called Endnote.
I watched its fleeting monochromes pass in the reflection of your aviator goggles. Plains and sky that slid like currents into the hollows of your cheeks. Gathering miles of the kind.
They're just like such a good example of it being used well. They're much, much more Sprechstimme.
Mm-hmm.
It's spoken word poetry, a guy called Pete Simonelli, who just performs over these quite complex post-rock meets post-hardcore musical backdrops. They're a bit more angular. They're sort of like a blend of like Grails and Jesus Lizard and Slint and a lot of stuff going on in there. Musically, it's really satisfying, and he delivers these quite affecting sort of spoken word lyrics over the top. We mentioned Wet Leg. I'm sure everybody and their fucking dog knows the song Chaise Long by now.
Would you like us to assign someone to worry your mother?
Excuse me.
What?
Excuse me.
That single made heavy use of it. Other songs they've put out kind of alternate a little bit more between actual vocal melodies and Sprechgesang. I think these guys and a few others in this category, particularly you rely on the work of people like the Modern Lovers. Do you know the track Roadrunner? It's a radio on. I'll cut it in here. That song in particular really has that upbeat driving, excuse the pun with Roadrunner, but that driving thing with the vocal just rabbiting away over the top of it. Not too hostile, just adding all the pace.
Fuck it, hostile. No, that's definitely not.
It's definitely not. Another one we mentioned, Dry Cleaning, songs in particular like Scratchyard Lanyard, very similar trajectory as a band to yes. Life Without Buildings. So you basically had four folk in the band who were kind of doing post-hardcore projects and instrumental stuff. They meet a female pal in this case again with a penchant for poetry, an English accent, who doesn't really have any aspirations to be in a band, but she finds herself there at the same time. They've done pretty well. I find their music almost as dull as their name, unlike Life Without Buildings, where Sue's vocal really ricochets off the music and ups the energy. Dry Cleaning to me just slaps this breathy wet blanket over everything. Even the way it's mixed, where the vocal is really, really high in the mix, I find it really quite tedious. I don't understand why the band are as big as they are.
Yeah, I mean, they're quite punk rock. A lot of this stuff is quite punk rock. I mean that in the sense of like, it's just outside the mainstream, but it's also a bit zeitgeisty. Mm-hmm. It's got a political message, also a bit angular and unapproachable to certain people, you know. So for younger people, it's quite alluring. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that you get this, oh, I've not really heard that before, that's weird, that's kind of cool actually.
I just thought that quote from cream.com was so bang on though. When you're listening to Dry Cleaning, you're like, why am I not listening to Live Without Buildings?
Yeah.
It's a Tokyo bouncy ball, it's an Oslo bouncy ball, it's a Rio de Janeiro bouncy ball. Filter, I love these mighty oaks, don't you? Do everything and feel nothing, wristband, theme park, scratch card.
I just think it's a very inferior version of something that's
been done. I do agree. I do think they're quite dull. But
yeah, you got this band Black Country New Road, they've mentioned a few times.
Also very dull,
yeah.
Running out of options to treat. What a funny way to speak.
Generally more of a kind of Nick Cave approach to this, where the vocal's so relaxed that the pitch is just ambiguous rather than there being no pitch. You've got Fontaine's DC, the Irish band.
Don't you really don't know where the avenue was go? Are you learning through your teeth or are they paying through your nose? A set of manners and a smile, that's all they want you for.
I'm not so sure they're a great example of it. They've got a track called Skinty Fear. It's literally more just monotonous, and I don't mean monotonous in a pejorative way. I mean like it's one tone that the vocal is delivered in, and it's more that than spracking, in my opinion.
Like some Interpol, I guess, or some Joy Division.
Joy Division is probably a better one. He's got a loose singing voice, and there's definitely a touch of it there, but I don't think Fontaine's DC are a brilliant comparison. Protomartyr, band that I mentioned.
Yeah.
When the ending comes, is it gonna run at us like a wild-eyed animal? A foreign disease.
A band that's also vanished for wider conversation almost as quickly as they arrived. Hugely hyped on the alternative scene for a short while. I actually went to see them at the CCA in Glasgow and left before the end of the show. I thought it was boring as fuck. Musically, they have some very interesting moments. I get that. They're a bit more aggressive. The vocal's a bit more insistent. It's a bit more edgy in the spoken way. It kind of goes a bit towards like Slayford Mods and Marquee Smith, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's more the conversational than the singing sessional.
I just find that the product so fucking dull overall, because the novelty of them just wears off.
And I think it
ends up feeling so gimmicky. Yard Act are a band that
Yard Act, yeah, they're doing really well as well.
And I'm not as poor as you were, and I still get positively sick when all the bellboys call me sir, because you never get used to the power that a proper trench coat brings, the way that it swishes and swings, it sings.
very slick production, which sets them apart from a lot of the older bands we're comparing them to. The vocal approach of them varies. Some of the stuff like Trenchcoat Museum is pretty much on the money, but We Make Hits.
Yeah, I admit it, document on tape, the greatest crime this nation's saving grace, devised and then committed.
I just wanna make a point that the culture. Aside to being a fucking terrible song, it reminds me much more of sort of baggy Britpop groups like Black Grape. Black Grape did a lot of this kind of thing, you know, just very loose because he was shite at singing.
Sean Ryder, aye.
Yeah, aye. Squid is a band that goes.
Yeah, I tried.
I've not heard these guys
talk. So their new album, their last album was not really for me. Quite adventurous musically, goes in various different directions, you know, but I can really jive it because of the vocal.
I think a good example is Black Midi.
Really don't like that band.
Well, whatever you think of their music, they lean way into this. Yeah, way into sure. this. And the music
they're
is so
great musicians as well.
Oh, they're amazing. Clearly very musicians, good musicians. Yeah, I don't want to listen to it, but the music is so complex and so proggy.
They're all Brit school as well.
Is that what it is, eh?
Yeah, we first brought that up in the last episode.
Oh, they're really really able people. I mean, the vocal is also fairly gonzo, the way he goes about it. The approach to the vocal feels closer to like Primus or something.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Do you know
yeah.
what I mean? Out of New Orleans and he traveled with the carnival shows. Ran bump cars, sucked cheap cigars, and he candied up his nose. He got wind of the big brown beaver, so he thought he'd dig himself a peek. But the beaver was quick, and he grabbed him by the kiwis, and he ate his bowl.
To be fair, but I think he probably falls into that category quite a lot himself, Les Claypool.
Yeah. Mm. It does, aye. You mentioned a couple as well. You want to bring up some of those?
Yeah, so leading more into the stuff that I kind of know. It's kind of more post-hardcore-y, straddling hardcore. And it's more towards the screaming end of the spectrum, but that's still a valid vocal technique. And the biggest example for me is a band called Tushy Amori, who have come up a few times in this show.
Mm-hmm.
Jeremy's whole vocal approach has always just been to shout, but not scream, but shout. Because when you talk to him, his talking voice is pretty much exactly the same as his singing voice. He's just shouting over the music, and there is a bit of pitchiness to it. And sometimes he does sing as well, more so in more recent records
right.
than he used to in the other records. But the way that it's delivered and the way that the lyrics work is it feels a bit like spoken word as well. So
it is interesting yeah. that you're saying he's gravitated towards singing, because you would run out of road with that trick. It's one yeah. of those things in music that's a bit of a dead end after a while. You can explore it and then eventually you're just repeating yourself.
They were a band that started off as being a post-hardcore band and kind of became mellower as they went on and mm-hmm. became a lot more interesting and did a lot more interesting guitar and bass and things like that in their music. Their peers are probably bands like La Dispute. You in my dreams, you were stitching up the seams on every broken promise that your body couldn't keep. I think I saw you in my sleep. I thought I heard the door open. Oh, no, thought I heard the door open, but I only heard it close. I thought I heard it play. Who are very much spoken word day. Maybe getting less so now, but back in the day, the first couple of records definitely were. And Me Without You are probably the ones that are seen as being the band which kind of brought this into this genre of music. They were, so they broke up in 2022, but they were kind of really concept band, and they did a lot of it was spoken word day and mumbly, and it was more in the Spreckus teamy as opposed to the Spreckus sang. And I don't know, like, there are other examples, there's a few in this genre. I mean,
you'd mentioned Drug Church and Self-Defense Family.
Nothing Patrick Kinlan, so he kind of got mostly known for being a collective called Self Defence Family, who are like a project with him as a vocalist and a couple of other collaborators, but it was like a revolving door approach to all the musicians. Sometimes when they go on tour, they record songs in the cities they were in, so they recorded a song in Glasgow. Our friend Stephen Struggletown put out the record, it's pretty cool. A couple of guys for that band went on to form a band called Drug Church, who have become a much bigger going solid concern.
Yeah.
And he's Self Defence Family. Elliot Drug Church starts off with that kind of spoken wordy vocal, but now he does a little bit more, maybe just getting better as a singer, a bit more baritone kind of singing vocal,
right,
along with it now. Really interesting band. They have hooks now as well, which is pretty cool.
You'd mentioned the Hold Steady. I could hear it on them.
The Hold Steady are definitely like the sort of punk rock adjacent example. They're kind of like Gaslight Anthem before Gaslight Anthem were really a thing. Bruce Springsteen inspired New Jersey kind of heartland rock, but with a bit of punk rock.
Yeah, I can hear the Springsteen thing in it. Yeah.
Craig Finn has always been well regarded as a vocalist. He's always been a bit divisive because of his approach and his delivery, which was at the time when they came out very unique.
Yeah,
you know, in that genre of music, and still remains so to this day. And that's a big selling point for a lot of people in that band, is him and his vocal. So yeah, there's a huge amount of it in that for sure.
Some of the other ones you'd brought up, Piano's Become the Teeth.
Yeah, Piano's Become the Teeth are contemporaneous with La Dispute and Tushy Amore and all that.
So they're quite screamo, but I think with a lot of screamo bands,
it falls in this category.
When they rein it in, it becomes sort of like that, and it becomes like spoken like that. Yeah, before they go back into another bit of...
Yeah. You'll hear it in bits of Circle Takes a Square. There's definitely some of that in this. Orchid will do stuff like that too, you know. And when it's not being pure, like you said, full on, they'll lapse into that. Converge do it as well. Jacob Bannon does.
Yeah, he does actually. Does you're right, yeah. War and Women, I could hear some pitchy stuff in that.
So there's a few songs, War and Women's earlier stuff, where Shauna does the kind of, literally like a spoken wordy sort of pitchy thing. It's a song in particular I'm thinking about called Comments on YouTube. The hook of the song is
just reading the comments and
the hook of the song is the song is decent, but the lyrics are laughable, and they're a really big massive feminist band, so the comments on YouTube are just like basically guys slagging them for being feminist and saying like misogynistic stuff. It's quite funny, but the way it's delivered is very much
in typical women getting men to do all the work.
But they're cool. Yeah, they're pretty cool, and they're more towards screaming and kind of singing now, but back in the day.
So I mean, that's a truckload of different examples. I mean, I do think there is truth that we're in the midst, or maybe actually
we're in a post-punk revival.
Well, maybe the peak has passed though, you know, but there's a lot of bands have made a lot of hay out of this approach.
Idols are one we haven't mentioned.
Idols, absolutely,
Who are probably about the biggest, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah, taking it to like stadium size. I mean, he's on fucking CBeebies now, isn't he?
Yeah.
Is that not just how you flex
these
days?
That's the barometer.
It's the anti-macho flex. Is like, are you big enough to go on CBeebies, ironically? But we'll bring it back
to... Ironically.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Some people like to deep clean every Saturday morning. I prefer to spend a few minutes every day keeping things fresh with Lysol. Lysol's all-purpose cleaner cleans and kills 99.9% of viruses and bacteria. It can be used on hard, non-porous surfaces like the kitchen, bathroom, and other areas in your home. Don't just clean, Lysol clean.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley, in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
We'll take things back to Life Without Buildings.
Life Without Buildings.
Yeah. So the sound has been described as polarizing. Obviously, the band themselves recall a lot of reviewers rejecting the vocal style completely. John Mulvey at NME early on.
It's called, a terrible review.
Called Sue's voice the scrape of fingernails on a blackboard. Only mad people and immediate family could warm to Tompkins. Whereas Guitar.com called her voice the core around which the rest of the record revolves. Pitchfork reviewed the reissue. They reissued the album in 2014. It got 8.7 out of 10. I think somewhat reflecting its cult status, because God knows Pitchfork didn't like to not have their finger on the pulse. But they said Tompkins' singing lands somewhere between scatting, talking and speaking in tongues. That review retells a story that in 2001 actually Life of the Buildings were bumped down a bill to support what would become the Strokes' first ever headline UK show.
No, it was just a scheduling it or an error on the bill or something.
Yeah,
like that.
So Robert Johnson said that they weren't bumped down and it had always been intended as support. The band had watched the Strokes for a few minutes and then left because they felt there was no real connection or sense of the bands being well suited to be in that bill together. It was pointed out by Pitchfork, and I think probably quite rightly, that fans do like that story of them being bumped down though, because regardless of the accuracy, it kind of illustrates a bit of underdog status. There's a nice quote in Muso Guide when they're talking about this album in the same vein that says that any other city is treasured by a strong proportion of the fans as a secret handshake. There's a sense of like being part of a special gang. There is something slightly esoteric about being into this band and being into this album. The fact
it was a bit covert.
Yeah, exactly. In terms of the breakup of the band, we said we're only together for 3 years and they split after making one album that seemed like it was doing pretty well. Like we said, they were going to Athens and playing to 650 people and things like that. The band's decision to split
toured widely, like the live albums in Sydney.
Aye, absolutely. They got around, aye. In Muso Soup, they did an interview. It was Robert Johnson and one of the other members, I think Will Bradley. And Robert Johnson had said that we broke up because Sue didn't want to do it anymore. When the band began, of course, none of us really thought anyone would be interested, so there wasn't anything at stake. We did some daft things like taking support gigs with larger bands because it would be, quote, good for us, and generally treating it more like a job than like fun. For Sue, I think it turned from a laugh into being a commitment she'd never signed up for. I think actually in that interview, Robert Johnson acknowledges that he was probably a big driving force behind them taking a lot of those supports, and he kind of got a little bit of an appetite for seeing how far this thing could go, but it just wasn't ever really intended to be that. The band have never had any plans to reform. They said they've not really ever even discussed it.
Good for them.
I think Robert Johnson said if they could do it all again, as in go back and, you know, restart as a project, he would probably have avoided the mainstream part of it entirely, not pursued the bigger support slots, kept the whole thing more manageable in terms of size and demands and perhaps longevity as a result. Will Bradley as well, the drummer, said he was always obsessed with DIY ethics and would sit and scrutinise in detail the wording of any of the contracts for just anything that might feel off. Nothing was taken for granted. It seems like they were all, this was not something that they set out to do. They didn't really have a huge appetite for it, even if a couple of them at some points got a wee bit tempted to see, and it just was not going to pan out as a heavy touring thing. Sue in particular was just not into that. Now, aside from that one album, they did put out a few singles, The Lean Over with New Town we mentioned. These were original versions of those songs that would appear that would go on to appear in the album. That initial single was reissued as a 7-inch that came out with the 2014 LP as well, as a kind of bonus thing. They also had a single, Is and the IRS. Is which had Let's Get Out, an alternative version on the B-side. They had a single, Young Offenders, with a B-side of Daylighting. Listen. The single Love Trinity, which was sort of backed by Is and the IRS. That was released only in Australia. And side A, Love Trinity, was recorded by Andy Miller, who would go on to do, or who would have done, the album. We mentioned they have a live album. They have Live at the Annandale Hotel for 2007. It was recorded in Sydney, Australia in December of 2001 on a fairly large tour. The band said they were actually unaware that the show was being recorded until much later, but they were pretty happy with how the recording turned out. It was released by Gargle Blast in the UK and then Absolutely Kosher over in the USA. And one thing that that live album shows to people who never caught the band live is that the vocals are not just freestyle improv. I think a lot of people are tempted to think that she was just rabbiting away and doing whatever. No, she had a structure and a flow, and the performances and the approach of the vocals is largely replicated live as well. And it's sort of a very useful bit of evidence to prove that, that this wasn't just somebody going in and going blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
She'd sat and worked this stuff out.
Yeah, that record is very close to what they sound like in that record.
It is. And it's got that live energy. As I said, I think it shows that we're a very good live band. The first track in that is called Liberty Philip, and I'm not sure if that ever appeared in any other studio recordings. It's a really good track. The bass line in it is lovely, really buoyant but quite understated, and the vocals in that one are ever so slightly more typically sung, still in quite a snotty style, but it does make me wonder if that was maybe a later bit of writing that they never got round to releasing. And from that, I mean, it's growing arms and legs here, but I do speculate, would they have gone in a slightly more sung direction to kind of broaden their horizons had they stuck about? Don't know. The 11th track in that is Sorrow, which is the closing track from the album. And this live version feels even more like the Velvet Underground, if that's possible. Incredibly lax and nihilistic and slackerish. And then Newtown, which finishes this show, I think it was actually the conclusion of the encore, really sees them rock out in the outro. Now that song has a bit of a kind of outro anyway, but they really jump up in that in the live setting, and they sound like such a good live band. Climax actually has something that they don't do very often, which is quite a lot of guitar processing, and the noise of the guitar spirals in a way that was quite reminiscent of some of the early Mogwai tracks, like Bits and Bobs off of Young Team and that. But yeah, I mean, that's it. It's a very minimal back catalogue, so it really just brings us round to Any Given City. My choice, my proposition for unsung status. I'd like to probably kick off discussing that album with looking at just the sound of it. It was recorded by that fella that I mentioned a second ago, Andy Miller, at a place called Chem 19, a studio in Hamilton in Scotland, just outside of Glasgow. He was integral to the Scottish, and you could say peripheral, alternative indie scene at the time. He'd done some of Young Team in 10 Rapid by Mogwai. He then went on and produced the entire The Hawk Is Howling album in conjunction with them. He'd worked with bands like Eska from Scotland, he'd worked with Delgados, he worked on The Red Thread by Arab Strap, one of their breakthroughs. He worked with Sons and Daughters, he worked with Fuck Off Machete, who were very cool for a short spell of time. He worked with My Latest Novel, who were a band that looked like they were going to go stratospheric. He worked with De Rosa, relatives of Our Vicky, as it happens. He also worked with Scout Niblet, and he worked on The Lioness by Songs Ohio.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Of the lioness to her man across the Nile, it is that look of the lioness.
So, I mean, in terms of the, like, being a key figure in an emerging indie sound, I mean, anybody that was familiar with the Scottish scene back then knows that anybody that's got the Delgados, Arab Strap, Sons and Daughters, Mogwai on their CV is very much in with the movers and shakers. The recording Any Other City has a really familiar roominess as a result. Like, the drums really sound in situ. You can hear them in that room. Probably the sound is one. It's one of those things that invites the earlier comparisons with things like Rodan and Farrakay as well, because those are bands that took advantage of the room sound quite a lot. You know, the guitars and the bass are not compressed too tightly. It sounds like a group playing. Doing it that way, though, you do sacrifice a little bit in terms of wallop. We mentioned this when we did the Mogwai record. It's maybe the difference between Come On Die Young, which was quite loose and quite analog, versus Mr. Beast, which was, you know, when you saw the waveforms, they were big solid rectangles, really heavily compressed. You got these big fuck you slabs of guitar that hit you in the face, auto rock and things like that, but it's a light touch versus that heavily compressed approach. So this album doesn't have the big wallops. Any impact has to come from the musicality and the dynamics. I think it also, maybe that lightness contributes to the sense of retro, because the heavy compression thing wasn't really done all that much, certainly not with the 90s post-hardcore, but even going back to like the 70s punk stuff, okay, the Stooges and stuff were quite saturated, but a lot of the kind of post-punk stuff we're talking about really wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually on the fence about the production of the album. I think it definitely sounds of a piece with the other 2001 era Scottish indie. The production has grown on me, it makes sense aesthetically, but I might have just preferred just a few more edges to counter some of the twee and the cringe in the vocals, because the vocals purposefully have twee and cringe in them. And I think something a little bit more snarly, I'm not saying it should have been recorded by Steve Albini, but a little bit more colour, a little bit more bite in it, I think would have been nice. I was just never a huge fan of Chem 19 recordings. I'm still not. I feel they're too mild, they're competent, but they lack a bit of personality. They just tend to be a bit safe.
Yeah.
And this record sounds like good songs to me, but I think they lack a little bit of impact and a little bit of character. And actually, the Live at the Annandale Hotel live record has just a bit more teeth,
mm-hmm.
You know?
I agree, yeah. It feels a bit featureless,
yeah.
You know?
Track by track, though, the first track, PS Exclusive, fucking hell, she comes straight out the gate with that vocal, doesn't she?
Very part life, very Kate Nash.
Deep
bouncy, cheerful opening number. Yeah, that phrase, the right stuff, is repeated 44 times in that song.
Yeah, I hate it.
It starts as it means to go on with the vocal. If you switch this off at track one, no problem, but I do think it's your loss. You can hear the Fugazi influences during the bridge at 2 minutes.
There's a lot of playfulness both musically and vocally to this song, you know.
You know the muted guitar pick thing that they do? That's very Fugazi. Yeah. Certainly as you get a little bit later in Fugazi especially. The song after that comes back in really blustery, but the bluster is all in the performance. You'd never hear distortion pedals getting switched on in this one. And I think by sheer repetition, that right stuff thing brute forces its way into your head as a refrain.
Yeah, the vocal was fine until the endless repetition of the right stuff, which did turn me off it. I was expecting to find the vocal quite egregious when you told me about it, when you gave me a description of the record, but I kind of didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Where it annoyed me, it wasn't sitting so high in the mix that I couldn't ignore it and listen to everything else, which I oftentimes would do.
That's the difference with dry cleaning. I think dry cleaning's mix, the vocal is so high that you just can't fucking get past it to enjoy the music.
Either. I was able to push where it was annoying. I was able to push past it and listen more closely to what the guitars and the bass were doing. And they play together very well, but they also counter melody and weave in and out of each other as well, which is pretty good.
They're effectively a power trio. Yeah. I mean, I realise that Sue's a huge part of it. That we've spoken about, for example, Placebo, Muse, bands that are only three musicians that sound way bigger because they're so good at complementing and filling the spaces and just working together.
Having that aesthetic without distortion, of having no distortion, means that you really need to be able to play because you can't hide.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
The second track, Let's Get Out, is ultimately really playful. Instrumentally, it deploys that low gain, early 2000s light emo, you know, soft post-hardcore approach.
Some lovely post-punk bass lines on this.
Really good. Really, really good bass stuff. If you hate her vocal, this track will be right up there. The ting-ting thing is very, you know, Life Without Buildings. The song ends really well for me, though. I think from about 2 minutes 25 onwards, it drops out and it builds up musically in a really rewarding, patient way. And again, that's all achieved by arrangement and dynamic playing, not with like a huge big, you know, rap pedal or
That mid late is quite mathy as well, which does remind me of Don Cab.
Mm-hmm.
And I quite like that. Yeah, I mean, her vocal was childlike, definitely. The way it's delivered made me completely uninterested in her lyrics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, the band are really fucking on it. And I should put my cards on the table just now and say I don't hate her vocal delivery in every single song.
Mm-hmm. No, I do think this is one of the ones, though, that it takes a tough chew. It really is. The third one, Juno. Mm-hmm. lovely use of guitar harmonics in this. It means that the bass does the bulk of the body of the song.
That's what I've said.
It's great that it's got a low key hooky chorus in it. Some really nice panning of the guitar and bass at 2 minutes 30 as well. The two of them suddenly pop out to the width of the stereo image. And I think actually when you hear them separated like that, and yet it doesn't sound unbalanced, it shows how on message those two players were together.
Her vocal was more effective in this. It's way less distracting.
Yeah, that's what I mean about the hook. It actually feels hooky.
Yeah, the guitars are the thing though. Like, they're natural harmonic. It's doing a lot of that kind of stuff. And the bass is playing so high in the register that it sounds like a rhythm guitar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah, it works really, really effectively.
Yeah. Track 4, The Lean Over. I mean, as you said, it's fucking approaching 14 million streams, viral sensation. And musically, I'll be honest, I don't think it's among their better tracks.
It sounds like American football to me.
Is it? You know what, that's an interesting comparison, because I really know what you mean there. That is that light post-hardcore touch that I think we're talking about. And I'm not a massive fan of American football, to be honest. I also don't particularly enjoy her take on this one at all. It's one of the most avant-garde vocal performances here. I think if you wanted to soundbite and illustrate her vocal approach, in fact, I may already have done that when editing this show, that would be the one. That line, "he's the shaking baby" thing, is pretty significant for fans of the band. You know, it's a hook. It's also got a really long fade-out ending that I don't understand as a decision creatively. Yeah.
The thing I liked about her voice in this song is like she actually modulates it with the music for a large part of the song, so she's going up and down with the backing. Around 3:20, it does like a bit of a build-up before it goes to that fade-out, and I wish there was something there to make it really feel like a build-up, but it doesn't, you know, and her vocal doesn't do it, and the production doesn't really do it either. You know, it just kind of feels, it's like, oh, we're getting somewhere, and then it gets to the peak, and you're like, oh, it's not really went that far.
Feels like it needs an overdub or something, the fifth track, Young Offenders, it's a bit more urgent and immediate. This track in particular sounds like it's got a fair bit in common with some of the lighter post-hardcore, and the chorus is a bit more sung in it. Just prior to 2 minutes as well, some distortion kicks in. Don't even notice that, and it jumps up a gear. I really like that bit. I mean, when used sparingly in an album that has very, very little distortion, when you hear it, you're like, oh,
yeah. I didn't like this song when I first heard it, but it was actually when we listened to the live album that I actually quite liked the song.
Stealer,
because I've written in my notes here that a vocal kind of blows past me, but it's actually got a hooky chorus.
It does.
Which I didn't notice in the first pass.
It's the most sung one as well.
Yeah, uh-huh. And then, but hearing it live, I was like, oh, it actually makes so much more sense live. Yeah, it's a bit of block party guitar work in here, I think.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
It's that, you know, more driving thing, yeah, as well. Uh-huh, yeah,
for sure. It's quite playful. Often the band are just playful. A lot of the post-rock stuff and a lot of the kind of 90s post-hardcore stuff, the guitars in the Midwestern Emblem, the guitars are actually playful. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not big slabs of chords. They're kind of weird, windy little chordy progressions or picky parts that are kind of slammed together in a sort of like, oh, this feels kind of nice and jointy sort of way.
Yeah, kind of overlapping it. And interweaving, yeah. Mm-hmm. The sixth track, Philip, I think also is a bit more direct and post-hardcore.
I love the guitars in this one. It's the Midwest emo all over.
Well, I had Cap and Jazz down for this one in particular. I think as well, go back and listen to our very early episode, Dundee is Fundy. We spoke about the city in the northeast of Scotland, around about, you know, the mid to early 2000s. There was just a sound coming from that town. It was very fecund for good alternative hardcore and punk and indie stuff. You can hear a lot of the parallels with what was happening up there. And I mean, that this band were about at that time as well.
The guitars are the thing in this one again for me. There's a bit of a Sonic Youth vibe in the guitars as well, I think.
Yeah. You know, Sonic Youth's not a name that we really brought up earlier in the show. It just seemed like a little bit too obvious of a comparison even. I mean, I'm saying that, but we said The Fall plenty of times. But Sonic Youth aren't a band that I really thought about in terms of Sprechgesang, but yeah, they obviously do it quite a bit.
Yeah, this song straddles eras for me. It's got a bit of the 80s, a bit of the 90s. It's pretty cool. Pam Newton bit in the middle was really nice. The bass guitar to kind of call and response thing, which I really liked.
Seventh track, Envoys, has a strong flavour of Juno 44.
Yeah.
Slower in pacing, there's a lot of space left in the music. The melodic chorus breaks in this one are really nice, albeit I don't think her vocal sits as well within the music on this tune, which leaves the guys to do, I think, a lot of the better work on this one. The bass led bridge at 2 minutes 10 is a really nice breather.
Yeah.
And she really goes to town on the scatting as the track builds back in. It's a Marmite moment, I think, depending on your take on the band. Especially given how nice the music is, her vocal is very difficult.
Yeah. The chord progression is probably my favourite on the record in this one. The guitar chords are generally really well chosen. I really like the structure. That is a bit more laid back, and it's got some meditative sections which I quite like. It does build up towards the end, and that assault vocal is just, that was like, that turned me right off, to be honest.
14 Days, the 8th track, that's a nice direct tune with almost a garagey proto-punk 70s feel.
Reminded me of The Promise Ring.
It did. Oh God, I was hearing much older stuff. I was hearing like Patti Smith and stuff in the vocal as well, you know. It's got a more distinct chorus. It's got a really obviously chorus, and probably deserves, I think, to be one of the better known cuts for the album. Has a really fun solo in it as well, 1 minute 20, which I think is the only moment on the album that they do anything like that.
Yeah.
That solo as well sounds a bit like Television.
Yeah.
And it's got a really, I'd say, euphoric. It's mildly euphoric, if there is such a thing, the outro.
Yeah, the outro is the thing which I really liked about it. The vocal itself overall in this song is very approachable, mm-hmm. which yeah. often isn't in this record.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the vocal in this song actually is the closest that she gets to Patti Smith as well. Number 9, Newtown. Last cut for this band. This track deserves way more streams than the Lean Over for me. Such a nice, simple guitar refrain. It's a brilliant bass part. It leaves so much room for Sue to do her work without a tussle for the attention. It's crouty in feel. It's quite similar to Noi, actually. She structures her contributions in this song, ramping them up with the music. The chorus is the same notes, but it's the same root notes, but it's just a dynamic performance thing, and she adapts her line to reflect that really, really well, which helps define it. Song comes back down again for a couple of minutes, but then builds up towards this really lush ending, and it's a bit that they capitalise upon to good effect, mm-hmm. as I said, in the live album. That line, you do what you have to do, do it, do it, is one of her best hooks, full stop. Albeit harkening back to the Cranberries, you know, I'm searching food for you. This is back in the Christmas episode when we were asked about misheard lyrics. When she's repeating looking in your eyes, in that English accent, looking in your ass. It's looking in your ass. It's clearly looking in your ass.
Yeah, the bass kind of doubles as a second guitar in this one. It goes in multiple directions. The guitars, drums and bass at the same time,
yeah.
often.
Yeah.
Which does make it a really nice...
Oh, brilliantly worked out song.
Yeah, very much so. Yes, it's a constantly evolving landscape, the music in this song, and her vocal has a hypnotic quality to it as a result.
And it's such a sweet spot for the band. It's like one of the best coming togethers.
Yeah.
And then it finishes with Sorrow, which will really test...
The cover of the Bad Religion song.
Yeah. Will really test people's tolerance for her vocal style.
The door fast slip away. You're beautiful, but slip away. You're beautiful, but you're gonna slip away like that, feeling that way about difficult people.
It's my least favourite song in the record. I'm not a Velvet Underground fan, and this as a result just feels really meh to me. It actually is really close to the song Sweet Jane. It's too close to the song Sweet Jane. I can understand why they put it last. It's a subdued ending, but it's a total skipper for me. And as much as I have slowly come to terms with Sue's vocal on it, I think just the song overall was a bridge too far. I don't dig it.
It's quite bluesy in places, which don't really do. If there was an actual more melodic vocal, I think it could have been more satisfying for me to listen to.
Yeah, I mean, her vocal's too much in this one, yeah. and the song is too weak. It's just the worst of all worlds as far as they're concerned.
It's got some cool walking bass lines on it.
But I mean, the bass stuff's always pretty good, but it needs to happen in context, you know.
Yeah.
I think in conclusion, right, so the summing up Life Without Buildings and why I've brought them forward, they're a one-album wonder. I think we actually even mentioned them in that context way back. I think it was a fascinating decision for them to split on the brink of potential market success.
It's a and pure DIY thing, isn't it?
It is, and you know me, I really respect that, and as a decision, I think that's really elevated this album. It makes it feel kind of special. I get why fans that are into this album feel like it's a secret handshake, you know? I totally follow that thinking. Are they divisive? Are the vocals divisive? Let's be honest. Yes, they're very Marmite. Even for me now, as someone that does like the record, there are still days where I'm just like, no, fuck off. I don't want to hear this. But I feel that this band are probably one of the best and definitely one of the most maybe even the most genuine examples of this approach to post-punk. It's been imitated to lesser effect by other people, and I think a lot of those other people were looking for an easy solution to a musical problem, because I think that's something that we didn't really address when we were going through them, is that, like, one thing about this style of vocal is it's really fucking easy, you know. Okay, it takes a bit of charisma, but in terms of, like, sitting trying to work out great vocals and actually having a good voice, which is even harder, because fucking
a lot of people don't.
A lot of people just don't, no matter how hard they try.
But even Lou Reed had it.
It's just, it can be a very, very easy way to be in a band. And when you're surrounded by bands, all they have to do is do that, and yeah, and then they got a fucking hit single in it, yeah, man, yeah. Mm-hmm. Then it's kind of galling. When you're in another band where you're fucking labouring over harmonies and trying to work things out and stuff. So I think Life Without Buildings sound like that was a natural part of their music, whereas I think other bands sound like they're just like, I want to be big, yeah, let's just do this. And that fucks me right off them, and it seems quite transparent, especially at a time when doing that kind of vocal kind of gives you an advantage. And that's kind of what Florence Shaw, is that her name, the singer from Dry Cleaning, was saying. She thought that they'd kind of get overlooked, and instead they got snapped up, and it's because this is in vogue. And yeah, that's pretty shit. I don't think Life Without Buildings were even remotely part of that. They were a standout because they were one of the only bands doing it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and this record has really humble ambitions and more or less smashes through them by just being a very accomplished record.
Yeah.
It's not perfect. There's a couple of songs in it that I literally just don't like. I don't think the production adds a lot. I think it's fine. It's nice. It's honest, but it doesn't have a lot of personality. But I think they retired satisfied, and fucking fair fucks to them for not trying to milk it, for not trying to rinse it, for just being a good band for a bit and then stop.
Yeah, I admire that, you know, I really do admire that. And yeah, again, like I said back at the start of the, we started talking about the album, I was expecting to hate the vocal so much, and it is what it is, man. But it was a post-hardcore and a sort of Midwestern emo that really reeled me in for this record and made me want to actually listen to it more, which was a nice surprise, because you know what I think about post-punk, right?
So, yeah, I know, totally.
So that was like, oh shit, this is actually doing something a bit more interesting than just some 80s Morrissey knockoff, you know?
Aye.
So yeah, no, dig it.
Awesome. Well, that's an unexpectedly positive result.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Right, well, that brings us to the last hurdle.
The Nexus.
The Nexus, Mark.
A complicated series of connections between different things.
The Nexus. So, again, this week, we were out and about, we did the pull anything out of the tub, but I randomly said to you, Mark, gave a name for the Nexus, and what was the name you gave me?
Enver Hoxha.
Hoxha, is it Hoxha? Hoxha? So, basically, Enver, let's just say Hoxha, it was the dictator of the People's Socialist Republic of Albania from 1944 to 1985, when he died.
This is you say that to her, but just under a half of Albanians still think you had a positive influence in the country.
No, I definitely didn't. I mean, it was a cult of personality. He was brutally repressive. He murdered his opponents. Fucking people just summarily executed, disappeared. Now, it's funny that you suggested him, though, because it turns out we were reading the exact same book at the exact same time, which is Free by, is it Leah AP?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I think it's a good book. You think it's an okay book, but it details her childhood in Albania and trying to like process what was going on, this around about the fall of the Berlin Wall and things like that. Albania didn't actually, I mean, it was democratized from about 1991, but in terms of being dissolved officially, it wasn't until 1998 that the PSRA finally vanished from the maps.
Well, when democracy came in, it ended up being a massive pyramid scheme, which took most of the money from most of the people in the country.
Yeah.
It ended up with a civil war.
Albania is a tough time, yeah. Mm. But yeah, so you suggested this, and I was like, whoa, what are the chances? Life Without Buildings was my choice, so I should go first.
Go, go, go.
As I mentioned during the episode, Life Without Buildings initially met at a Transmission Gallery in Glasgow. They used to have gigs and stuff there. They still occasionally do, but not with anything like the frequency that they used to. Transmission, as I briefly mentioned, is an art-strung gallery. It's in the Trongate area. It's the oldest such gallery in the city. It's been there since 1983. Well, it's existed since 1983. It changed location in 1989. It moved from Chisholm Street, which is just around the corner, to what's called a white cube space that it now occupies in King Street, just a very neutral white room for exhibitions and things like that. Transmission has a history of alumni, including on the board of directors, which includes at least two winners of the Turner Prize. Maybe more, actually, because I don't keep track of winners of the Turner Prize. One of them was definitely Simon Starlin, who turned a shed into a boat, sailed it down the River Rhine, and then turned it back into a shed again and got absolute pelters. You know, even what Turner Prizes are like. And I think one of the tabloids did the same thing, where they sailed a shed down, I don't know, like a canal in Birmingham or something like that, to take the piss out of it. The other Turner Prize winner who was on the board there, that I know of anyway, was Douglas Gordon, who was the first person to win the Turner Prize with video medium. Douglas Gordon went on to direct the film Zidane, a 21st century portrait, which followed Zidane, the player, around the pitch during a Real Madrid match. The score, the soundtrack for that movie, was written and performed by Mogwai.
Mogwai.
Yeah. Stuart Braithwaite of Mogwai is a pretty outspoken Celtic fan, doing, you know, interviews for Celtic View magazine, amongst many other things. The current Celtic team and their manager, Brendan Rodgers, went to the Vatican last year and met in person with Pope Francis, presenting them with a signed Celtic strip, and presumably Brendan bidding them farewell with good boy. Now, this is fucking brilliant. This is actually probably the highlight of my day. Talking of a Sprechgesang, Mark, have you heard Pope Francis's prog rock album Wake Up from 2015?
I've heard of it, I haven't heard it.
Que il dovere del conclave era di dare un vescovo a Roma. Sembra che i miei fratelli cardinali sono andati a prendere.
Wow!
Che ella nos haga discípulos come lo fue ella. Y misionero, como también lo fue ella, que nos enseñe a salir a la calle, que nos enseñe a salir de nosotros mismos.
Salve Regina.
So it's produced by a guy called Don Giulio Neroni, who is the Vatican's official record producer, it seems, who's also worked on albums for previous popes, including Lil John Paul Doss.
Padre d'Israele, il padre degli uomini, ma il padre suo, il padre mio,
padre nostro, Jesus.
And the notorious B.E.N., also known as Benedict XVI, the bad boy of papal pop.
Yeah.
it turns out that the last three popes have all had records produced by Don Giulio Neroni.
I want that job.
Well, I've put samples in here and I was thrilled by it. It's Sprechgesang in the sense that it's various proggy bits of music with then Pope Francis sort of dialogue, prayers, wading in over the top of it. Outstanding.
Yeah.
Christopher Lee would be proud.
There's probably some, there'll be some cultural director at the Vatican who thinks that this is a great way to try and reach the kids.
Prog rock.
Yeah, totally.
It was actually Pope Francis, presumably between tours, who canonised Mother Teresa. And also, I might add, I now know that canonization requires a second miracle after beatification's first miracle. I didn't know that until today. Mother Teresa.
What was her second miracle?
Fuck knows. Got very mixed feelings at the moment. Yeah. She was also Albanian Indian.
Oh.
Yeah. Mother Teresa was unable to see her sister or her mother for certainly the last years of their life. I don't know, it was even decades. The family were, as I say, Albanian Indian, and the mother and sister lived in Albania. but as a resolutely communist anti-theist state, Mother Teresa's admittance was denied multiple times by Enver Hoxha.
Well done, well done. So here's mine. The bass player from Life Without Buildings was Chris Evans. Not that Chris Evans or the other Chris
or
Evans.
Or the other Chris Evans.
But, you know, another Chris Evans.
Chris Evans, brackets three.
Yeah. apparently, he completed his Masters in Fine Art in 1993 at the Winchester School of Art.
Uh-huh.
And notable alumni of that very school of art is Mr. Brian Eno, or Eno, however you want to put it.
Oh, yeah.
He's obviously a legendary
Brian
musician.
Eno.
Obviously a legendary musician and producer. He's worked with a number of musicians over the years, like John Cale and U2 and Genesis, speaking of prog, David Bowie.
That's how you reach the kids.
Devo and, speaking of reaching the kids, Coldplay. He's played or produced a song for the band on pretty much every record since their third album, X and Y.
That's why they're so good.
Coldplay are pretty boring. I think they're pretty boring. I don't know. They might not be. We've not done an unsung on them yet, so it remains to be seen if they're actually boring.
It'd be the biggest reach in unsung history.
I suspect they may be boring.
They are officially very boring.
They have released nine albums somehow. I don't know how. But in 2011, they released their fifth album, Milo Zotto. And on that tour, their opening act was
Emily Sandy.
It's the I at the end that goes, yeah. Fucks me up. Emily Sandy. Born in England, but brought up in Alford, Aberdeenshire. She's also a fairly bland, well-known singer, like Coldplay.
Did really well for a while. I remember when she was played at like Oran Mor, just before she absolutely exploded. Oran Mor being not too far from here.
Yeah. Somewhat improbably, she was given the key to the city of Tirana in 2017.
Really?
Yes.
Tirana, okay.
The capital of Albania.
Yeah,
So apparently she performed there on Independence Day, which is the 24th of November.
Yeah.
And then after the performance, it was so emotional, they just gave her the key to say,
here, let yourself into anybody's house.
Yeah. So obviously at this point, I would say that, Tirana is the seat of power in Albania, and Enver Hoxha ruled from there.
Comrade
Hoxha, yeah. But he also, before he became the leader of the Communist Party,
he was in Emily Sandy's band.
He was, he was actually a teacher at the gymnasium in Tirana as well. Just some other random facts here before I've completed the Nexus, but another couple of things that I think are quite cool. There's some other people who have also probably been given the key to the city.
Are you okay?
Tirana. One of them is Fatboy Slim.
Fucking hell.
The two others you're going to be a bit nonplussed when I say them, but they totally make sense. Rita Ora and Dua Lipa have both been given the key to the city as well.
All right.
They're both English Albanian. So Rita Ora's actually from Kosovo. She was actually born in Kosovo, and her family are Kosovo Albanian.
Yeah.
Dua Lipa, she was born in London, but her parents are from Kosovo Albanian.
Yeah. Like, I knew about the Rita Ora thing because I was reading about the Balkans for an episode that we're about to do.
Yeah. And so apparently Dua Lipa is also a cultural ambassador for Albania, and she was just granted citizenship of the country in 2022 for her work and trying to get people to come to the country, which is really interesting.
That's interesting.
And also, final fact, Kosovo Albanians are the largest ethnic group in Kosovo. There's over 1.7 million of them.
Yes.
Which is also very interesting.
Well, I tell you what, seeing as you're so fascinated by the Balkans, Mark.
Yeah, I was thinking about this. It's all coming round full circle.
What if...
Let's get fucking depressed.
Next week, to get back on the happy train... We do an episode on a phenomenon known as turbo folk.
Nazis.
You mean the fascists are unavoidably involved in the breakup of the former Yugoslavia. We are going to talk about turbo folk, which is, in a nutshell, a weird mix of like folk music, quite racist nationalist folk music, and sort of hip hop bling aesthetics, braggadocio, and involves mass murdering butchers married to pop stars, and ultimately helped fuel the various Balkan conflicts that destroyed Yugoslavia and killed tens of thousands of people and led to concentration camps and all kinds of ugly shit. At the heart of that was, or somewhere at the heart of that,
somewhere, not right at the heart of it,
amidst a number of other factors,
orbiting the heart of it,
was a thing called turbo folk, and it's going to blow your fucking tiny minds. So we will discuss that in a politically charged episode of the show next week.
I am excited.
Brace thyself, by the way. Honestly, the musical samples are going to be fucking horrendous for starters, but they will thankfully be offset by the absolute grotesquery of what went on.
Mm. I look forward to that, and so should you. See you next week.
See you then.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.